And it's my pleasure to introduce to you folks, all the way from New York, Larchmont, New York. I don't know where that is, but that's back in New York somewhere. Ray O.K.
My name is Ray O'Keefe, and I'm an alcoholic. Very nice to be here. I am a member of the world-famous Mamaroneck Group, located in Mamaroneck, New York. You have heard of that group, no doubt. I am authorized by our steering committee to wish you a happy conference. The vote of our committee was 11-7. It's always good to be at an AA conference and to see so many happy AA people. And I was also delighted to find so many of the Al-Anon people here and so active. I thought perhaps the Al-Anon ladies would be attending a meeting in San Francisco this evening, being held in the mother church of all Al-Anon, the Church of Our Lady of Perpetual Revenge. Let me tell you about my drinking. I don't want you to miss any of this. This is a thrill a minute. I grew up in one of the neighborhoods in New York City, and my neighborhood was rough, and it was tough, and it was Irish. Now, you won't understand it here on the coast, what they drank in that neighborhood. And if you looked at my house, you'd see a little drinking. My mother, the widow O'Keefe, was known to take a drink from time to time. And when the pressure got on, Kitty would go for the light wines and the spirits. And something would fly, usually one of the children. My brother Billy was a very bad drinker. And in the neighborhood of Irish drunks, Billy O'Keefe stood out. So when I showed up at the local place and ordered up whatever it was they were serving 14-year-olds that afternoon, no one paid any attention to me. It was just another O'Keefe coming by. I don't even actually recall what they gave me that day. I suspect it was a beer. That was a neighborhood drink. But whatever it was, I liked it. I liked everything about it. I liked the way it looked. I liked the way it smelled. I liked the way it tasted. I liked what it did for my head. I liked the noise and the smoke and the confusion. I liked the fist fights and the Irish music. I liked the bullshit. That's what I really liked. I was going through the parochial school system, in a manner of speaking, and I got into all of the difficulties and problems you might imagine a young man would get into trying to go through that system drunk. I was thrown out of high school a number of times. I held the neighborhood record for being thrown out of high school, a record previously set by my brother Billy. When I was finished with high school, or more properly put, when they were finished with me, because someone made a mistake somewhere in a small school in New England, I got a chance to leave the neighborhood, and I went away to college. And my drinking changed. There were no bars in that state. There were just restaurants. And these people sat around at tables, and they drank beer out of bottles, and they sang college songs, and they wore white shoes in the wintertime. And being a man of no particular moral fiber, I got a pair of white shoes. I learned the words of some of those songs. I got very collegiate. World War II was just about over. Things were slow on the campus. So one afternoon, I went for a haircut and joined the Navy. I was sent out here to San Francisco on a minesweeper, and I hate to be indelicate in front of such a large gathering, but I have to tell you, I had a lot of trouble with my kidneys when I drank. And in the Navy, we slept three to a tier, and a new man slept on top. Don't get ahead of me, lady. This is very hard here now. I came back from my first liberty in San Francisco with all the beer and me I could buy. And I went to bed and I had one of these rare nephritis attacks. And I got to meet the fellow who slept below me that night. He figured he'd be wet sometime in his naval career, but it just hadn't occurred to him it would happen while he was sleeping. I was immediately transferred to the lower bunk. One day, this mighty ship of the line, bristling with armament, was floating around in the South Pacific, trying to stay out of harm's way. We were delivering the mail, is what we were doing, bringing the mail to our fighting men. And the executive officer sent for me, and he told me something I was to hear many, many times in my life, and it never helped me with my drinking. In fact, if anything, I suppose it hurt. He said, "You are a very, very smart kid, O'Keefe." And I agreed with him right away. He was beginning to show good judgment. He told me if I could pass some exams, they would send me to the United States Naval Academy. And so about 3 months later, I found myself in a very fancy preparatory school in Maryland. And I was only there a matter of months when the executive officer of the school sent for me. His experience must have been a little different than the other man's, because he threw me out of the school. Told me they had rules about people like me who went over the fence and came back drunk and started a riot. And he suggested that I resign my appointment and rejoin the fleet. In fact, he put his suggestion in the form of a written order. I got ready to be sent far, far away as punishment, but with characteristic military efficiency, I was placed on board the yacht of the President of the United States. I would like to amuse you with tales of intimacy with the President and my participation in affairs of state. Unfortunately, I have no such report to make. I got paid, and then I got drunk, and then I got paid, and then I got drunk, and that's how I spent the balance of my enlistment. I came back home to the neighborhood. Everything was under control in the neighborhood. The widow was out in the weeds somewhere. My brother Billy was over the hill from the New York City Police Department, having invited a citizen of Puerto Rican ancestry off a five-story roof. The citizen bounced and lived to identify the Irish cop. Billy came west. The 5220 Club was available for heroes. I qualified for a few checks. I gravitated to the local joint. I took up the game of shuffleboard. And I was planning a life of petty crime with some of my boyhood companions when I had one of those clear thoughts that come in from time to time. I recall that I'd been to college. So I got on a bus and I went back up there. And I arrived in the middle of a blizzard, and I walked into this joint, and there they were, sitting around a table, drinking beer out of bottles, singing those songs, wearing those shoes. So I got another pair of shoes. And now a grateful government was sending me a check every month, so I was moderately solvent and therefore moderately drunk all the time. I was staggering around a campus in my usual shape one day, and I saw a list of names on a bulletin board of people who were qualified to graduate, and my name was on the list. And that was very good news. I thought I had another year to go. So I sent for the widow to come witness this great event, and that was a rather tender sight. The widow and her youngest child staggering around the elms. When I got back home, the question was what to do, and my uncles, who ran the family, had voted unanimously that I become a New York City policeman. That's what my father had been. That's what my brother had been. That's what all my uncles and cousins were doing, except for the two morons that worked for the phone company. But I told those guys that I wasn't going to be a New York City policeman, that I had received a scholarship for law school, and I'd be unemployed for the next several years. And that was received with mixed emotions, but that's what I did. I went to school. I always did what I wanted to do. That's part of being an alcoholic. And when I got to law school, my drinking changed again. I never met a lawyer before I went to law school. We didn't have any lawyers in my neighborhood. We had cops and we had priests. We didn't need any lawyers. I hate to be disloyal to the profession, but I have to tell you, when I got to law school, I found I was in the company of the biggest collection of stiffs that had ever assembled under one roof. These people were all deadly, and they all had on a suit, and they all had on a vest, and they all wore eyeglasses. So after I got the uniform and managed to get a pair of glasses I don't think I needed, I looked around for somebody to drink with, a companion. My mother told me, play with nice boys your own age. But nobody drank in that crowd. They were all studying. They were all grinding away. So I became the biggest grind they ever had in that place. And I didn't drink at all in my first year, and very rarely in the next 2 years. With the result that when I came out of school, I was taken into a large, white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant, Wall Street law firm. They hired me as sort of the resident immigrant. And my superiors there determined I ought to be trained as a trial lawyer. So I was sent up to New York City to learn my trade. And I wasn't in the courthouse in New York very long when I discovered that all the wise guys were across the street in a saloon. So I moved my office into the saloon. And I learned to drink in a different, in a more civilized, in a more genteel fashion. Very few members of the profession were knocking down shots and beers or anybody could see them. I discovered scotch in a tall glass with ice and water. And you sip on that. It takes a little while, but it gets the job done. I was introduced to all of the mysteries and all of the ritual that surrounds the very, very dry martini. And to this day, to this minute, my love, my admiration, and my affection for the very, very dry martini is surely the greatest case of unrequited love the world has ever seen. I was so loyal to those things, and they almost destroyed me. After about a year of this civilizing influence, it was necessary in my natural development that I be married. And I had located a lady, or she had located me. I'm not sure how those things work. Ms. O'Keefe, my wife, my current wife, I always call her my current wife. I find it keeps her on her toes. Ms. O'Keefe is from a totally different background than mine. She was raised in a large home with devoted parents and servants and a fence and a dog in Westchester County. And I drank a lot in those days, but I knew what was going on. I will not burden you with the details of my wedding day, but I assure you that when the O'Keefes from the South Bronx hit the Westchester Country Club, they set a few records. There was only one fight. It was not a particularly good fight. My Uncle Bernie hit a waiter. After that, we set up light housekeeping, and Mrs. O'Keefe began to produce children in a rather boring and monotonous fashion. And with the regularity that's known only to the devout Roman Catholic. And after the second or so of these events, I received a phone call from the law school I had attended, and the dean invited me down to see him, and I went to see the dean, and he appointed me a professor of law. And there I was, the boy professor. And I was very concerned about that job because I really wasn't sure what there was in my background to justify that. and I knew that I drank a great deal. So I decided that I would cut down on my drinking. I decided that I would control my drinking. And I was then 26 years of age when I thought I had to control my drinking. And I was very unsuccessful at that. But as the years went by, after about 3 years of trying to control my drinking, I became secure about the teaching. So I went out to drink the way I liked to drink. In fact, it was the only way I knew how to drink. My father died when I was 2. My brother Billy taught me all of the finer things of life, including how to drink. I drank like Billy. I drank until I fell down, or the place went on fire, or the cops arrived, or something happened. And in this period of time, too, I rattled around and did a lot of things that are no longer interesting. I hung around New York and did those things that lawyers do when they're on the make. I roamed around the city. I was on the periphery of a lot of things. I even ran for office one time and lost. And the only thing I look back on with any satisfaction at all is that I was among a group of people in the state of New York in the middle 50s who surrounded the candidacy of a young senator from Massachusetts that you will remember and served on his staff a while. And in this period of time, too, Mrs. O'Keefe and I bought a large, semi-authentic colonial home in a village called Larchmont, New York, a village which abounds in semi-authentic colonial homes. And we added up to 5 or 6 children and the usual number of motor vehicles and the usual memberships and the usual obscure clubs. And had you asked me in those days how I was doing, I would have told you I was doing very well. In fact, I would have told you that whether you asked me or not. It was one of my favorite themes. Truth of the matter was, at this time, at age 34, I had turned into a terrific daily drunk. And my day would have killed a lesser man. I used to come to in the morning in that wet bed because the problem with the kidneys had continued unabated all those years. And I would struggle out of that damp sack and begin my morning calisthenics. My calisthenics were performed kneeling on the floor of a bathroom with my head in a bowl. And I'd have all the water running, the water in the shower and the water in the tub and the water in the sink, because I did not want Mrs. O'Keefe and all of those little O'Keefes to know that Professor O'Keefe was dying. I would struggle downstairs in my sincere blue suit with a vest, carrying over my shoulder, much like Santa Claus, a sack of wet laundry. Because Ms. O'Keefe told me that the diaper service was for the children. And she did not think that a lady of her extreme breeding ought to do the wash of a 34-year-old bedwetter. You can imagine a man of my stature in the community starting off each morning with a load of wash. But once I got my wash out of the way, help was at hand. I used to keep a quart of vodka in the refrigerator. My children call that Daddy's juice. And I would take a few bangs on Daddy's juice, and then the question was, would I throw up in front of all those people? I knew if I lit up a cigarette, it was all over. Sooner or later, I'd get into New York, and I'd arrive in Grand Central. And if you know anything about New York City, you know that Grand Central is not a railroad terminal. It is a collection of saloons that are connected by tunnels. And I'd tear around the tunnels like a mole, and I'd pop up here or there. I'd have a couple and do a repair job, and then I would head for Fordham University School of Law, and I would arrive at that imposing institution. And as soon as I got on the inside of that place, I thought, how do I get out of here? And I'd get out and I'd tear across town to a law firm and I'd steal. Every day I'd steal $20 from the petty cash. And there's nothing like giving a drunk money. It's like whole blood. And I'd be out on the Park Avenue with my 20 and I'd be into a taxi. And I would go down to where I really belonged, my first parish. The bars down by the courthouse. And by this time, the other lawyers were treating me like some kind of a mascot or a playmate or something. And I'd run in and I'd throw up my dough and I'd buy a drink and they'd buy a drink and the bartender would buy a drink. And we'd have a great time and maybe we'd eat some lunch and maybe we wouldn't. And maybe we'd talk about some business and maybe we wouldn't. And maybe we'd settle something and maybe we wouldn't. But the important thing was that the whiskey kept coming. I had it figured out in some alcoholic way that I was particularly brilliant at about 2 o'clock. So I had scheduled all my classes for 2, and I'd tear up to the law school and shortchange the kids, and then I'd zoom out of there, and I'd jump into a taxi and go over back to Grand Central to commute. Now, even though I grew up in the city, I understood the theory of commuting. Commuters are entitled to a drink before they get on the train. So I'd have 10 or 12, and I'd take a train going north. It didn't have to go to Larchmont. North was good enough for me. And I got to see a great deal more of Bridgeport, Connecticut than any civilized man ought have to. Sooner or later, I'd arrive home and I'd bounce off a few walls and take what was left of Daddy's juice out of the refrigerator and fill up an old cheese glass that some kid had left laying around and inquire if anybody wanted a martini. But I was the only one that drank in that house. So I'd have a few pops, and then I'd eat or not eat, depending on my mood. Evenings, I would spend in civic endeavor. Civic endeavor by me was cracking up the car, or puking on some hostess's sofa, or playing a little grab-ass with the ladies of Larchmont, and a sorrier-looking crop you have never seen. Most evenings, I would just stay home and vegetate, and I would watch television with one eye like this, trying to get those sets to go, and I'd watch. And I'd drink, and I'd watch TV with one eye, and I would go through the programming, and through the news, and through the late show, and through everything else. And finally, my big moment would come when they played the Star Spangled Banner. And the Marines would go up Mount Suribachi. And the destroyers would cut through the water. And the planes would fly by. And they'd play that song. And I would cry. Oh, I would weep and sob and cry. And then I'd go upstairs and wet the bed. That was it. Now, this is not once in a while. This is every day. Weekends, I would save for binges. And if everybody around me would mind their own business, which was extremely rare, I could get drunk 3 times on Saturday and 3 times on Sunday. Well, as anybody who's ever been married can tell you, during this period of time, Mrs. O'Keefe was not entirely silent. From time to time, she would have the temerity to suggest that there was something radically wrong with the way I drank. But I'd pay no attention to her. Why should I? First of all, she's a woman, and women don't know anything. Secondly, she is not an attorney, and I would tell her that. Then we would have the discussion, and I'd say, now, wait, stop, you know. I mean, you talk about things you know nothing about. It's all relative. I don't drink that much. Say, as a matter of fact, I don't drink as much as my mother. And she'd say, nobody drinks as much. So I'd be out the door. Well, this drove her crazy. And she betook herself to a physician who, as you might imagine, is an obstetrician. You got to stay with me now. I'm going a little faster, you know what I'm saying? He could find nothing the matter with her until she told him that she lived with a drunk. And this explained a lot of things to him. And he sent her home to my house with a message. And I used to sit in this house. We had a room there. It was a very pleasant house. We don't live in that house anymore. We had some more children. We childrened ourselves out of that house. That's a polite expression of how we came to move from there. Not too fast, is it? I'm going all right. And there was a room in that house. There was a den. It was very nice and paneled and had fireplace. It was very pleasant. And on the wall of that room, I had erected a shrine. Now, the shrine was not to any saint that you ever heard of. This shrine was to me. And there were pictures of O'Keefe with the great and the near great. And there were diplomas and plaques and mementos of political campaigns. And there were letters, you know, Dear Ray, best regards, Jack, that kind of stuff all over the wall. And I would sit there and watch the TV or whatever, and I'd be getting drunk. And during a commercial, I'd look up at the wall and I'd think to myself, you are really something. And Well, Mrs. O'Keefe came to pay a visit to the shrine this evening. And the message she brought me was that her doctor, the obstetrician, had diagnosed her husband, the professor, as an alcoholic. I was extremely disturbed. I rose to defend myself, as was my custom. I began my jury address, and the first point I made was a good point. I took a very dim view of a physician who would diagnose a patient without having seen him. I was against that shabby practice. And then I went into high gear and I asked Mrs. O'Keefe a question to which she has not yet discovered the answer. I asked her what kind of a man became an obstetrician in the first place. A little worse than I thought. And at this point, the conversation was coming downhill at a terrible rate. And then it happened. I don't know how this happened. I cannot explain how it happened other than to say that it happened. I have no explanation for it. I can explain many, many other things to you, and I probably will in the second or third hour of this terrific talk that I'm giving you. But in the middle of all of this confusion, I suddenly stopped. And I admitted to Mrs. O'Keefe for the first time that I had ever admitted to anyone that there was at least the possibility that I drank too much sometimes. This was a very serious tactical error. Because 3 days later, I found myself a prisoner in a mental institution in Stamford, Connecticut. And I'd only been there a matter of moments when I discovered a very serious architectural deficiency in the building. There was no doorknob on my side of the door. They had sandbagged the old professor. And I mentioned this to some cretin who was walking around in a white coat. And I grabbed this man in the white coat, whose intelligence was something in question. And I very carefully explained to this medical person that in addition to all of the other difficulties I seemed to be facing, it happened to be the occasion of my 35th birthday. And therefore, under the Constitution of the United States of America, I had just become eligible for the office of president. He urged me not to plan any campaign. He said there were two other presidents in residence. Washington and Jefferson were there, I think. And he went away and he left me. And then I did, for all of the rest of the weeks, or the week or so, I did all of those wonderful, warm, pleasant, happy, and interesting things that alcoholics do when they withdraw from alcohol. I shook. I sweat. I did everything else remarkable that you can think about. And I finally came up for air, and I was then visited by the staff of the hospital. This was not Gene Duffy's place. This was a very fancy rattlebox. And the first one in to see me was the head of the hospital. And he fixed his cool, professional glance upon me. And he asked me that question that so many people insist on asking alcoholics. It's such a brilliant line of inquiry. He said, "Tell me, Professor, why do you drink so much?" So I told him. I told him of my wealthy parents. I told him that when Mamsie and Dada used to travel, they left me in the hands of cruel servants who were black. And I had become insecure and turned toward alcohol. And he was very sympathetic. He went away. About an hour later, another psychiatrist came in and he asked me the same question. So I told him. One doesn't lie to a professional. I told him of my impoverished youth. I told him of the beatings I had received at the hands of my drunken mother. I even told him about the time my sister Marie stole my rubber duck when I was 3 years of age. He said I'd come to the right place. Said help was at hand. Said with his help and with the help of medical science, one day I would drink safely again. I said, "Thank you, doctor." He was my kind of a doctor, that doctor. And the last psychiatrist that came in to see me, and the last psychiatrist that I have ever seen, with the exception of one I drive to meetings now from time to time, this last one was a man of dubious medical qualifications and a pronounced Middle European accent. And he was fascinated by two things. One was my professorial status, and the other was the fact that I was wearing sneakers in January. We had a long chat about the footwear. He found some mysterious significance there that truly had escaped me completely until he mentioned it. And then we had a long chat about it, and he finally asked me the same question, so I told him. I gave him a sexual aberration that drove him out of the room. He thought he'd been given a great degenerate to work with. And perhaps he had. Well, I wasn't as smart as I wanted everybody to think because they had a staff meeting. And they came to the conclusion that there was a fraud in their hospital. And so they sent for Mrs. O'Keefe. And poor Mrs. O'Keefe had to come up through the snow and the ice. And I was brought into a room almost as large as this, and she was in the middle of it, hysterical. And she told me that I was in grave danger of being expelled from a mental institution. And I said, "Let's go." But she prevailed upon me to stay. She was determined that I would become sober if it took the last dime her father ever made. And it almost did. Well, I went back to where I was staying, and I was playing Monopoly with three guys who were there. They weren't alcoholics. They were just there. And one of them was under the impression that I was his real estate broker. And if you know anything about the game of Monopoly, and some nut thinks you're his real estate broker, you can do very, very well. I had the boardwalk, had a number of hotels. I was well into the Monopoly marathon, and soon after that, they told me I had another visitor, and I didn't know who to expect, so I went to my room to see what was happening, and through the door of that room came this very imposing-looking guy, and he told me that he was from the Darien, Connecticut Alcoholics Anonymous group, and the hospital had asked him to speak to me about this program. And I reverted to type. I said, "Alcoholics, now what, are you out of your mind?" And I went right at his throat. And he told me to shut up. Really? I knew he had not been properly instructed. I knew they had forgotten to tell him exactly who I was. So I continued to speak. He told me to sit down and to shut up. and to listen to him. Well, he was an imposing-looking guy, and I was not a well person. And so for the first time in 35 years, I sat and he began to explain to me, as I have really been trying to indicate to you, what his life had been like, how he had come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and what life had been for him since. And he asked me if I would like to go with him to meetings. And I said, "Do you mean outside to meetings, sir?" He said, "Outside." I said, "I'll go." Besides that, he gave me matches. No one else had allowed me to have any matches. So that's how it began with me. He drove me all over, and he made arrangements for me to go locally, and I came out, and I started to go locally, and I don't recall all so much of that. I was too nervous and too new and too afraid and too everything, and besides, they had turned me loose from that rattle box with a large jar of those pills that they insist on giving alcoholics. And as a friend of mine says, that I was dealing with that segment of the medical profession that considers the disease of alcoholism to be some type of a Valium deficiency. I stole that from Clancy. So I walked around at these meetings and my head buzzed a lot. But I know myself fairly well. I figured I would come to Alcoholics Anonymous. You would recognize me as a superior person. You would elect me your president. I was always president when I joined something. I would serve a term as your president. You would give me a plaque. I'd put it on the wall at a shrine. And that's it. Onward and upward. Well, it didn't quite work out that way. And it should come as no surprise to you, but it was a terrible shock to me that some 10 months later, I found myself very, very drunk. And this time, of course, I was drunk with a great difference because I had turned away from the great power that is in our program. And I was to stay drunk for a period of time, and I won't take you through it because it takes too long and it still gives me the willies. But just let me say to you that it was, without question, the worst period of my life. It was murder. It was pure and simple murder. I never knew whether I'd be drinking or not drinking. I never knew, once I began drinking, where I would be when I was finished drinking. Things began to happen to me in this period of time that had never happened to me before. And I do not recall now, and I do not speak to you, of things that happened to me in this period of time that I no longer consider to be significant. I do not speak to you of the fact that I was dismissed from the faculty and fired as a tenured professor of law. Not all of the prestige of the profession that had been mine was taken from me. I do not speak to you of the fact that I was in serious, and I mean very serious, personal, professional, and financial difficulties. I do not even speak to you of the fact that I lost the affection of all those who were around me. All of this happened to me in this period of time, but that is not what I am speaking to you about. What I am now able to appreciate happened to me in this period of time is that there was, in my case, and perhaps in yours, a terrible, terrible wasting of my spirit. My spirit, that thing that separates me from my cat and separates me even from each of you. That spirit which gives to this particular form whatever individuality or personality or character that it might have. And this was a spirit which once burned in me so bright. And it was, for all practical purposes, extinguished, and I knew it, and there was nothing that I could do about it. Because by this time I'd been here, and this was not for me. And by this time I'd been everywhere else. I'd been through the hospitals and the drying out places, and I'd been through the jobs and the politics and the money and my friends and my family and my wife's family, and I've been through the doctors and the nurses and the clergy, and I've been up and down every avenue there was, and the result was always the same. I was drunk. And it wasn't as though I didn't know about alcoholism. I knew about alcoholism. I had a memory. I remembered the neighborhood. I knew about my family. I had been to the funerals. I knew what happened to people who drank the way I did. And if I gave this any thought at all, I thought, well, if that's the way it is, that's the way it is. And so I continued to drink. And I truly, truly did not think it would end as it did. For my time came one day. My time came one day. It seems to me, and it's simply my opinion, that there is a time for all of us. And there is a time for each of us. And I say to you that there is a line somewhere beyond which we simply are not permitted to go. And I say to you that there is a point somewhere below which we simply are not permitted to sink. And I say to you that there is a level of pain somewhere beyond which no human is required to endure. Now, I don't know where this line is for you. I can only tell you what happened to me. And this is a very personal and individual thing. And it is different in each case. And for some, it may be death. And that's the way it was for my brother Billy. I received a phone call one night from the Veterans Hospital in Minneapolis, and the man told me that my brother had died of alcoholism in the Veterans Hospital where he had been taken from the Skid Row of Minneapolis. And so my brother died without friends, without family, and a long way from our neighborhood. But my brother Billy doesn't drink anymore. And that's how he stopped. And for someone else, it can be something fairly trivial. But the line is there somewhere. And we must all come to it in our own time and in our own way.
But come to it, we must. And I came to it on a day that really wasn't so different than any other day. I was 3 or 4 days away from a drink. I was in what then passed for my office. I was nervous, upset. I was thirsty. And I thought I'd go cross street and have a few pops. I knew I'd feel better. But instead of doing that, I was moved to call a friend of mine who is a longtime member of this program, and he is my sponsor, and his name is John. And John came over to see me, and he came into that office, and he looked so good, and I felt so bad. And I asked him what I would have to do to be as successful as he was in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And John gave me that look that he has, and he said, "Don't drink. Go to the meetings. You'll be all right." Well, I didn't want him to tell me that, and I told him I didn't want him to tell me that. I said, "You see, John, you really should know a few more things about me." I said, "For instance, this place where I work, this is no place for a man of my stature." And he said, "Well, don't drink, and you go to the meetings, they'll get a little better." I said, "Now at home, you know, I can't go back up there, John. You remember what happened up there." "Yeah," he said, "well, don't drink, and you go to the meetings, and it'll be all right." I said, "Now, I got this letter here from the bank, you know, John, about the money." "Well," he said, "don't drink, and you go to the meetings, you'll be all straightened out there." I sensed that there was no dialogue there. And so did John, because he made a few phone calls and he put me on a train to Larchmont. It's about a 40-minute ride, and halfway up, I reconsidered. You know, tell I call him for. What does he know, huh? Don't drink, right? Don't drink, huh? Don't drink, my ass, don't drink. Fellas, train stops. That was my attitude, and I got off the platform at Larchmont, and standing on a platform was my mailman, a guy named Al, who was then chairman of the world-famous America Group. And Al said, "Get in a car." And I said, "Get out of here, Al. I don't hang around with mailmen." Al said, "Some guy named John called me about you. Get in a car." Well, a man of my stature cannot afford to have a fist fight with a mailman. Or anybody else, for that matter. So I got in Al's car. I said, "Al, I'm in a lot of trouble, Al." And Al said, "Yeah, well, don't drink. And you go to meetings, you'll be all right." So if any of you are foolish enough to ask my advice because I've come such a long distance, that's it. Don't drink. You go to the meeting. She'll be all right. And Al took me for a ride and came back that night and took me up to the world famous. And I didn't drink that day. And I haven't had a drink since. And sometimes when I'm not thinking properly, it seems a long time. It's really not so long. It's 15 years. But first, I had that day. And I had that day because two members of our fellowship were so filled with the gratitude of our fellowship that they took what God sent that day, a drunken, dishonest, arrogant man. And because they were so very grateful for what they had received, they gave me a day. And it is, I hope, that same sense of gratitude that allows me to be with you this evening. Because like John, like Al, like every member of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have a great debt to pay. And this is one of the ways that I do that. And after I had that day, I had the succeeding days, and I would see John every day. He'd find me in the courthouse, and I'd see Al at night, and I'd get my instructions. And after I'd been doing this for a number of months, John grabbed me one day, and he said, "You know, Raymond, you're not such a very bad fellow after all. He said, you don't drink. You're going to the meetings." He said, "There's much more." He said, "There's a great deal more to Alcoholics Anonymous besides not drinking." He said, "It's time for you to learn something about the program." He said, "It's time for you to read the book." Now, because I'm the way I am, I said, "Oh, come on, will you, John? What are you kidding me? Read a book. Rarely have we seen anyone fail. We're thoroughly followed." And John gave me that look. You know that look? The look that longtime members of AA reserve for smart-ass people. And John said, "Read it again." And I said, "Yes, John." Because by that time, my sponsor had taken me to the point where I hope your sponsor has taken you, where no matter what he said, ultimately I'd say, "Yes, John." So I began to read again the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. I was appalled at my initial ignorance. I did not truly understand that the book had been written some 5 years after the meeting of Bob and Bill, and that the book was more or less a chronicle of the early members of Alcoholics Anonymous. I did not understand that the steps that are contained in the fifth chapter of that book were steps literally taken by these men and women who had become sober. I thought when first I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, well, if I told you that my name was Ray O'Keefe and that I was an alcoholic, I was doing something about the first step. Of course, that's my name and I'm an alcoholic. But the men and women who founded our program did a great deal more than simply identify themselves as alcoholics. They admitted that they were powerless over alcohol, that their lives had become unmanageable. And their lives had become unmanageable because they were powerless over alcohol. It was all the same thing with them. They were powerless. They had no power. They were without power. It says in our book that the alcoholic's dilemma is his lack of power. He has no capacity for power. He is truly powerless. But they didn't drink. And time began to pass for them. And time has passed for me and for this great conference. And if you come here new, time will pass for you. And time has a wonderful way of passing in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It passes one day at a time. And somewhere after this succession of days, these men and these women came to believe that there was a power greater than their own. And they believed that this power could restore them to sanity. And this was not just a casual observation that they made or an offhand reference that they shared. They believed this. They truly believed. This was part of them. This belief that there was this power greater than their own. And so true and so real was that belief that they were able to make a decision to turn over their will and their lives to the care of this power that they had come to believe in, this God, as they each understood him. And they were very, very bright, because at a time in the history of this country when no one else had this notion, they conceived alcoholism to be a disease. They conceived it to be a disease that was physical and mental and spiritual, a disease of the body and of the mind and of the spirit. And when they stopped drinking, they found that their bodies responded quickly. And when they came to believe, they began a mental recovery. It was slower than the physical recovery, but it was perceptible. They could notice it. And when they made that decision, when they decided to turn over their lives, that wasn't so much. They had already admitted that their lives were unmanageable. But when they made the decision to turn over the will, the alcoholic will, that thing, that was the thing that had me in all of that trouble for all of those years, and I never knew it. I was, and even sometimes I remain, what the book describes, an extreme example of self-will run riot. But when they were able to make that decision to turn over their will to the care of this God of their understanding, when they were able truly to surrender, when they were able to let go and to let God, they began not only a spiritual recovery, but they set down the basis for a spiritual way of life to which you and I are heir. They left that to us. And they were very, very bright too, because they knew that it wasn't enough to simply stop drinking and start praying. A lot of people have tried that. It just doesn't seem to work. They knew that if they were to be successful, somehow they would have to change. And in order to effect this change in themselves, they began a searching and a fearless moral inventory of themselves. They sought to determine the exact nature of their wrongs. They could be searching because by now they were relatively clear. They could be fearless because they had made a decision to turn over their lives to the care of this God as they each understood him. Imagine an alcoholic without fear. That's impossible. It embarrasses me to tell you that the ruling emotion of my life when I drank was fear. For all of those years, the great man and the boy professor was afraid most of the time. But this program helps with that. And it was a great relief for me to be able to go to my sponsor and bring him my inventory. And it was he who made for me more exact, the exact nature of my wrong. And they developed an attitude which came fairly hard for me. They became entirely ready to have God remove all their defects of character. And with compelling logic, they went to this power that they had come to believe in, this God of their understanding, and they humbly asked him to remove their shortcomings. And it began to work for them. And no matter what else is ever said or thought or written about our program and this fellowship that you and I share, the one thing upon which there must be unanimity of opinion is that it works. It certainly works. And they were bright enough to know that they hadn't come here alone, but there was in their lives, as in mine, a certain amount of wreckage. And so they wrote a list of everyone they had ever harmed, and they became willing to make amends to everyone on the list. And they didn't just talk about it. They went out and they did it. And you may recall in our writings of this toll that Dr. Bob's first day on the program, he got home late that evening and Bill asked him where he'd been. And he said he was driving around Akron, Ohio, in his old Buick, mending fences. It's an old Vermont expression. He was making amends the first day that he was ever dry. And I don't think we need wait too long in our program to do all of the things that are expected of us. And it was at this point in the program that the men and women who founded it told us what had happened to them when they had completed the ninth step. And I have this little portion of the big book that our group puts out, and I've got some extra copies for the first 8,500 people who give up here my autograph or something. And it says, if we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. We are going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past or wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity, and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations that used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? We think not. They are being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They will always materialize if we work for them. And I'm happy to report to you that as a result of this program, each and every one of those promises have come into my life. And by this time, these people were fairly sober. And they knew that something precious had been given to them. And so they wished to maintain it. And in order to maintain it, they continued to take personal inventory. They knew they could not enjoy the luxury of a resentment. They knew if they were resentful, if they were hateful, they would drink. And if they drank, they would die. It was simple with them. And so when they were wrong, they promptly admitted that they were wrong. And so great and so real and so true was their reliance upon this power greater than their own, this God of their understanding, that they resolved that they would improve their conscious contact with God. And they did that by prayer and by meditation. They meditated. They gave thought to their condition. They considered who they were and what they were. And they engaged in a very fine and very excellent form of meditation. It is a form of meditation in which you are now engaged. They listened. They listened. On the odd chance that this power that they believed in would speak to them. And this power that they believed in did speak to them at their groups, in their meetings. And then they prayed, brothers. They prayed. And when they prayed only for knowledge God's will for them and the power to carry it out. and great things happened to them. I really cannot be sure how it was with you, but it always seemed to me, when I was young and going through school, it always seemed to me that I really just didn't belong. I had this feeling that I was in the wrong family, in the wrong neighborhood, in the wrong school, at the wrong time. And even though as I was coming along, the outside was fitting in fairly well, I had this terrible sensation that I just wasn't part of anything. I just really didn't belong to anything. And in the 12 and 12, in the chapter on prayer and meditation, in the last paragraph of that chapter, they tell us that as a result of prayer, I cannot quote it exactly, it says, a great sense of belonging comes to us. We are no longer lost or alone or afraid or purposeless. That despite all of the evidence to the contrary in a seemingly hostile world, we have discovered that the true values of life are love and truth and justice. And that we have discovered that a loving God watches over us, and that when we turn to Him, all will be well with us here and hereafter. And I have now that sense of belonging and being a part of. And when I tell you that I am a member of the world-famous Mamaroneck group, I mean to say to you that I belong to them, that I am part of. And a little later, they came upon a prayer that they thought appropriate, and so they took it. It's a prayer that you and I have already prayed. They prayed that God would grant them the serenity to accept the things they could not change. And they did change. Something happened to them. Something has happened to me. Something happens to everyone who comes here and puts this program into their lives and puts their lives into this program. There was a great difference in the lives of these men and women. There was a great difference between being drunk and being sober. There was a great conversion of their values and a great substitution of their standards. And this difference in them, the difference between being drunk and being sober, they termed a spiritual awakening. And they had this spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. And these were the men and the women who at the beginning of this process had admitted that they were hopeless and helpless and powerless. These were the ones who had no power. And having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, they found that they held in their hands and in their hearts, and in our program, one of the greatest sources of spiritual power that the world has ever seen. They actually had the power to arrest the disease of alcoholism. They actually had the power to save life. And the only thing they were using was the great power of example of one drunk for another. I wanted to be like my sponsor. And armed with that power, and having had that kind of a spiritual awakening, they began to carry the message to the alcoholic. And they did that so well that you and I have come together on a night in March in 1980 in this truly enchanted place, Monterey, California. And that, my dear brothers, is a long, long way from Akron, Ohio. And they knew what my sponsor knew. They knew that there was so much here, so much more, besides a simple device to keep me from drinking like a pig. They knew that what had been given to them was an entirely new way of living. And in order to enjoy that new way of life, they resolved that they would practice principles in all their affairs. And so where they had been, as I always was, arrogant, they tried not to be so arrogant. Where they had been, as I habitually was, dishonest, they tried not to be dishonest. Happily for me, and perhaps for us all, they said we need not be saints. They said it was not a program of spiritual perfection. It was a program of spiritual progress. And my sponsor has instructed me, and so I believe, that I can progress in the program if I don't drink and go to the meeting. I could keep you for many, many more minutes and tell you of all of the good and wonderful things that have come into my life wholly and solely and simply because I am a member of this fellowship. But I wouldn't keep you that long. If you have a good wish for me, and I know that you do, please be assured that anything at all that you might wish for me has already happened in my life, wholly and solely and simply, because I am a member of this fellowship. I now enjoy the warmth and the affection of those around me. I have completed two terms as the judge in my locality. And on January 1st of this year, after a 16-year sabbatical, I was reappointed a professor of law. I mention it because it's recent and I'm not used to it. And even more significantly, it is my happy duty to report to you that three of my children are members of Alcoholics Anonymous. There really isn't anything more that I can report. I certainly would be remiss if I did not thank whoever it was who had the extreme good sense to invite me here. This is truly a remarkable place. And you are, of course, a wonderful group to speak to. When I report back to the well-famous Mamaroneck group, as I am required to do by Section 13 of our bylaws, I will tell them of the time I have spent here in Monterey, and that during that time, you have been warm, made me welcome, and that I have felt at home. I am one of those members of Alcoholics Anonymous who travel a great deal in the program, and everywhere I go, I say about the same thing. And every time I leave, I say the same thing. And I bring you now to a pamphlet of Alcoholics Anonymous and ask you to recall with me a member's view of Alcoholics Anonymous. And at the end of that pamphlet, the author takes a biblical view. And he reminds us of the time when John the Baptist was once again languishing in one of Herod's prisons. And John sent two of his friends to inquire of his cousin Jesus as to whether or not he was the Messiah. And so these two men found the Lord, and they walked with him a while. And finally they stopped him one day, and they said to him, "Are you the Messiah? Are you the one that we've been waiting for? Or should we wait for another?" And the Lord really didn't answer that question. But he said to these two men, "Go back to John and tell John only what you have seen and only what you have heard. Tell John that the lame walk and the blind see, that the deaf hear and the sick are made well. And tell John that the poor have the gospel brought to them." In my early training, I was told that the word poor in that context could mean poor in spirit. And we all know that the word gospel simply means good news. And so, my brothers, here in Monterey, in Great Northern California Conference assembled, if you will accept a report from me based upon my years in Alcoholics Anonymous, I will tell you only what I have heard and only what I have seen. And based upon that observation, it seems to me that the lame do walk, and the blind do see, and I think the deaf can hear, and most certainly, the sick are made well. And I have seen over and over and over again the good news of our program brought to the alcoholic who still suffers, the poor in spirit. God bless you.